By now, you're probably familiar with the term NIMBY. If you're not, it's an acronym. It stands for Not In My Backyard. It's used in reference to a town or a city's proposal to place something that's not really desirable either in the middle of or right next to a residential neighborhood. Things like addiction centers or needle exchanges or garbage dumps, industrial plants, factories, that kind of stuff. And when that happens, the NIMBYs, as they're called, in the neighborhood will raise hell, debate and oppose and delay until the city backs off. In many neighborhoods, that often works. But all of those factories and plants and garbage dumps have to end up in somebody's backyard. And today's episode is about the backyards they do end up in. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Ingrid Waldron is a professor at the Faculty of Health at Dalhousie University and the author of There's Something in the Water, a book which was turned into a documentary film, which debuted at TIFF this month. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I find these kind of discussions are better when you start with a specific story. Was there one story of a particular place or community in Nova Scotia that inspired you to drill down on the work that led to this book?
Yeah, I think it was one of the first communities that I met and built a relationship with, and that's the African Nova Scotian community in Shelburne. There's an African Nova Scotian community in Lincolnville as well, but in Shelburne, I had in 2015, end of 2015, I wanted to hire somebody from Shelburne to do focus groups in their community to learn more about environmental racism. And I hired a woman by the name of Louise DeLille, who is featured in the documentary. And we were talking, and I was talking to her about the definition of environmental racism. And she said to me, oh, could that be the reason why everybody in my community has cancer? And she went on to say that basically, 96% of the people in her community had cancer, including her mother, who had fought cancer several times, her sister. Yeah, it was like everybody. And I thought this couldn't be. It was stunning what she was saying. And it was mostly women. And the men had died out. And there was actually an article written by a Nova Scotian journalist. The title of the article was A Community of Widows. So this is a low-income, rural African Nova Scotian community in the south end of Shelburne. The north end of Shelburne is predominantly white. The south end of Shelburne is predominantly black. The north end of Shelburne, the white community, is on town water. The south end of Shelburne with the black community is not on town water. And they have also been near a landfill since the 1940s. So she was making a connection between the landfill that's been there since the 1940s and the high rates of cancer, including multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer, which is extremely rare. So I think that's what, I mean, before then, I started the project in 2012. It was Lincolnville, and it was indigenous communities of, you know, Pictou Landing First Nation and Yarmouth. I had visited all of them, but, and I'm a health researcher, so that's why I got into this, because I wanted to know about cancer rates, et cetera. But when she said that basically everyone in my community has cancer, it kind of stopped me in my tracks, and I thought, wow, this is a real example of how environmental exposure impacts health. And, you know, one of the worst health outcomes you can have is cancer.
What happened when you brought to light what was going on in Shelburne, or even just as you dug into the story, has anything changed?
In Shelburne, lots of change. And I'm lucky to have Louise, who is a true leader, because the work I do is community-based research. And I feel it must be led by the community. Typically, you have academics go in, you know, and tell people what to do. And, you know, and that, for me, doesn't work with the kind of, you know, research that I do. So you want community leaders who will lead the research. And Louise has been a true leader. And because of her leadership, and of course, because of the support my project has given her with respect to funding and things that she could never access, the amount of accomplishments that she's made and other people in her community have made since 2015 when I met her, we implemented a water testing project. I brought together a hydrogeologist, an environmental scientist, environmental science students. We got some funding, and we did the first ever water testing project in Shelburne, so they could finally know what is in their water.
And what then we was could, in the water?
Right now, the first round of testing showed coliform and E. coli. Now, those are perhaps not as serious as some other types of contaminants like arsenic. Mm-hmm. However, they can create inflammation, and cancer is inflammation. You know, when you have inflammation in your body, it can lead to cancer. However, I spoke with Louise 2 days ago, and she said, Ingrid, we had some second round testing, and it's worse than the other tests, the results, and I am now super convinced that the contaminants in our water is causing us cancer. You know, because people were pretty wary about that in Nova Scotia. Right. Well, it's probably not the landfill, you know, stop complaining. Some of her the politicians in the area were saying that. But she says, we just did some round of testings. I didn't even talk to you about it yet, but it's much more serious. So that's one thing. We did water testing for the first time. She was able to get the landfill closed for the first time ever at the end of 2016. Now, that landfill has been open since the 1940s. So because of her leadership, she got it closed. Now, it's great that she got it closed. It's an accomplishment. However, the cancer rate is still there. It doesn't wash away the fact that the community has been exposed to contaminants that continue to impact them. She won a human rights award December of last year, a Nova Scotia Human Rights Award, her organization that she founded after she met me when she found out more about environmental racism. Her organization is called the South End Environmental Injustice Society, Incorporated, and they have done a lot of work around the landfill and health issues, so they got an award for that. We are putting in an ultrafiltration system in her community, which is supposed to clean, it's a kind of equipment that cleans out the water. A very innovative project that we're doing.
So that's a lot that's a lot of work for what one community was experiencing. And you mentioned the term environmental racism a couple of times. Can you define what mm-hmm. that is?
Environmental racism was not coined by me. It was coined in the United States by Reverend Benjamin Chavez in the early 1980s. And it refers to the disproportionate siting or location of hazardous industry in primarily communities of color, indigenous communities, and low-income white communities as well, low-income working-class white communities. So it's about disproportionality. It's about the fact that environmental policies and environmental assessments, which makes decisions about where an industry would be placed, tend to place those industries in communities that are not able to fight back. Not able to resist. So communities in Canada that are less able to resist and fight back are those that are marginalized, those that lie at the intersection of race, culture, low income, low socioeconomic status, residents in rural areas. They're less likely to fight back. If you place an industry on in a wealthy, you know, Nova Scotian community, a white community, they're going to be heard. They're going to say something. They have the resources, the political clout to get their voices heard. So when you're low income and racialized and black and indigenous living in out of the way places, you don't get to be heard sometimes and you're forgotten by policymakers. So environmental racism actually encapsulates all of that. It's the inability to fight back, to get your voice heard. The fact that environmental policies or discrimination gets written into environmental policies in ways that then lead to disproportionate exposure to contaminants and disproportionate health outcomes, which we call environmental health inequities, is the principal aspect of environmental racism.
So what did that look like? You've described Shelburne, but what did that look like across the province when you were examining some of the projects?
I would first say that if you go to my website, you will see a map that was created to show the location of industries in both Indigenous and Black communities. So if you go onto that map, you'll see two layers. You'll see one for the Black community, one for the Indigenous communities. And it's stunning, the amount of waste sites, landfills, pulp and paper mills, incinerators that are close to Black and Indigenous communities. So what it looks like is that even when I visited the communities, everyone had a story about, you know, waste, health inequities, environmental exposures. And the map shows that too very convincingly. What the map doesn't say and what I never say is that white communities are not near landfills. They are. So it doesn't mean that they're not. It just means that disproportionately you're going to find Black communities around those, clustered around waste sites and Indigenous communities, even more so than Black communities across Canada. We hear about pipelines all the time and they run through Indigenous communities. So there's no doubt that these are communities disproportionately impacted.
When you began researching your book, how well did you find that the people with the power understood this phenomenon and what was happening? I guess I'm trying to ask if it's conscious or unconscious.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned in the book that it's institutional, in a way unconscious. Some people would say to me, I think it's conscious. I think people sit in a room and plan to hurt people. I don't think it's that direct. I don't know if the word is unconscious, But I think in general, we have notions in our head about who we think has value, who we think has worth, who we think can fight back. And I think when you create policies, that gets written into policies. You know, if you don't think a particular community has value, then it makes perfect sense to locate a landfill near to that community. So maybe there's a conscious aspect to it, but I see it as subtle, and I see it as institutional.
In some sense, they're kind of choosing the path of least resistance, right?
Well,
because they don't want a horde of rich white people showing up at city council.
Exactly. And these are the communities that are less likely to do that. Now, that doesn't mean that they haven't done that. They've certainly been involved in resistance and mobilizing activities and environmental organizing, all those communities. But it's taken a long time for them to get heard. I think of Pictou Landing First Nation. That community has been dealing with a contaminated boat harbor site since 1967. And starting in the 1980s, they have been asking government to address it. And the government has promised to address it over that time, repeated promises, and never has. Now they're looking at a closure finally in January 31st, 2020. They've been certainly mobilizing around that. So it may happen finally, but the broken promises repeatedly since the early 1980s is very telling.
How does this story, or I guess this collection of stories, go from becoming kind of a research-driven book about communities in Nova Scotia to a documentary film that is, you got a lot of press at TIFF. And how did that happen? What changed?
A celebrity being involved in my project. I mean, it's Ellen Page, Nova Scotia-born actress who reached out October of last year, had read a book by Joan Baxter, a Nova Scotian journalist. She wrote a book called The Mill, and it was about Pictou Landing First Nation. It was focused solely on that issue. And Ellen wanted to find out more. I believe she said she Googled environmental racism, came to my name, came to my project website, and then found the Twitter. And in October, I went to my Twitter page, and I noticed somebody following me by the name of Ellen Page, but it didn't connect. I didn't think it was her because it says on the profile, tiny Canadian, said nothing about being an actress. So I was like, And then I went away, and then I came back 3 weeks later, and there's Ellen. There's a bunch of comments on my Twitter page talking about my book, asking people to get my book. I traced it back up to Ellen Page saying, you need to read Ingrid's book. It's essential. You must read it. And I said, so the Ellen Page that I noticed on my Twitter 3 weeks ago, is that the actress?
Oh.
And I realized it was. So I said, I'm going to reach out to her and thank her because I'd never seen so much action on my Twitter page. I'm not that good with you know, social media.
Like, that's how it happens these days.
Yeah, it was shocking. So I thanked her. And then in some, I don't know how this happened, but her longtime friend who owns a restaurant in Halifax said, I've known Ellen for 15 years. Do you want me to put you in touch with her? And we did, week of Christmas, of Christmas last year. And we were on the phone together, the three of us. And Ellen says, I want to use my celebrity to support you, to support your book, to support the women fighting against these issues. How can I do that? We spent some time thinking about how she lives in New York now. She moved from California. And I thought, well, I don't know how, if she lives in New York, how can she really help? And then I said, well, her Twitter following is almost 2 million people, I guess. That's powerful. Maybe when I tweet out something, she can retweet. I thought social media would be a good place for her. And then, you know, a few months went by and nothing happened. I was trying to figure out, I said, I have a celebrity willing to help me, but I can't seem to figure out how to fit her in. I was frustrated. Then we had another conversation, myself, her, and the women affected by environmental issues, Indigenous women specifically. And then we started talking about film. And Ellen said, maybe we can do a few clips, short clips. Just post it on social media, nothing big. We weren't thinking of TIFF and we weren't thinking of a feature film. You can post a few clips, get some exposure, and that's it. That's where it ended. And we all said, yeah! Everybody on the phone, they were excited. Oh, yes, everybody was screaming excited. She came April 10th until about the 20th, filmed probably 6 days. This is really renegade. And she got everything she wanted. Then I went back to view the footage with her and co-director Ian Daniel. And we realized that we had something bigger. And I thought these women had shared so much. Their stories were emotional, just kind of doing maybe a hack job where we just posted on Twitter. I thought we needed something much more respectful. I said to her, I said, these are serious issues. I know I've been doing this project for a while. It's emotional. I'm seeing the footage now, and I don't think we should just put it on Twitter. I think we need something else. That's when we started to talk about 70-minute film, a full-length feature. You know, we had a lot of footage, and how can we use it? Then I was the one who says, yeah, I think the best place to expose these issues is TIFF. Ian said, I'm not going to be offended if TIFF rejects us because I don't have the time. The deadline is in a few weeks, and I don't think I can do this. I said, I want TIFF. Anyway, so we now had a goal, and he was working 18 hours a day to try to get it through the deadline, but we never actually got to the deadline. Cameron Bailey, who runs TIFF, was kind enough to allow us to submit it after the deadline.
Well, tell me, I mean, you don't have to describe the whole film, but tell me about the women in mm-hmm. the film that you've mentioned a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Who are they and what are mm-hmm. their stories and how is it? How do they show up in the documentary?
Now, over the 7 years that I've been doing my project, there have been a lot of women, but because it's a 70-minute film, these are just three women who are featured at length, and then we have the grassroots grandmothers. So in the film, you would have Louise DeLille, who I talked about earlier, from Shelburne, mm-hmm. Who's been dealing with the landfill, and she takes us through the community. So her part is about driving through a car, much of it, and pointing out all the homes with people who have had cancer. She's really funny. She's humorous. She's stubborn. People are going to like her. I could feel it in the gala screening. People were laughing at certain points because she's humorous. She just has a lot of personality. She's very down home. People mm-hmm. are going to love her. Next up is Michelle Frances Denny, and she's from Peak Two Landing First Nation. And what's fascinating about her story is that it's very, she talks about it in an intergenerational way. She talks about missing and murdered women. She talks about suicide. She talks about alcoholism. She talks about environmental racism. I like the way that she connects everything together in the Indigenous communities, how all these things need to be discussed in a way that looks at how they intersect and how they're intergenerational, because she talks about her grandfather who signed a deal and sold the harbor to government
and that's
the
where
guilt
it came from.
And the guilt that he felt because of what has happened, because you're dealing with an oppressed community and somebody says, we'll pay you $60,000. You will agree to do it. So she's crying throughout the film because of his guilt. Then we go to Doreen Bernard, who has been fighting the Alton Gas Project for about 4 years now. And she's part of what they call the grassroots grandmothers. It's a group of 6 to 7 Indigenous women who identify different ways to address environmental racism, but other issues in their community. And it's very intimate. They sit around together in a group, and they talk about some of the challenges they've had dealing with the issue.
These examples are great because they're all from kind of one place that's a relatively small place compared to the size of Canada. So you can kind of see how localized it is. But how pervasive is this in Canada in general? Is this a Nova Scotia problem? Is it worse in Nova Scotia, or is this what we've got?
The film is a case study of Nova Scotia. My book, however, begins with Nova Scotia and goes more broadly. So through the research I've done and just through the people that I know, the activists, mm-hmm. this is a Canadian problem. And I think specifically of Ontario, and I think of Sarnia, Ontario, and you might have heard of Chemical Valley. Mm-hmm. And I know about Chemical Valley through readings, but also through an activist by the name of Vanessa Gray.
Describe it quickly for people who haven't heard
sure.
of it.
Sure. Sarnia, Ontario, Chemical Valley, the Indigenous community nearby is dealing with about 62 industries facing the community. And that's and they have very, extremely high rates of cancer.
Yeah.
And they also have reproductive health issues, birth anomalies. I don't know exactly the numbers, but you've got an out-of-whack
right.
male-to-female ratio, which is definitely directly as a result of environmental hazards. So just the notion that they have 62 hazardous industries surrounding the community is stunning. We have examples in British Columbia, Alberta, New Brunswick, Saskatchewan. Some people would actually frame urban area, you know, Toronto, an urban area, as having different cases of environmental racism. It's not just in rural communities.
Right.
When we think of low-income, racialized, maybe immigrant communities and where they live.
Why isn't this a federal issue if it's everywhere in Canada? Why aren't we talking about this until this documentary came out?
We're not talking about environmental racism enough, but we have been talking about environmental justice issues. I mean, recently a bill was put forward federally for an environmental bill of rights. Mm-hmm. I believe it didn't pass, right? Canada is one of the few countries that doesn't have a federal environmental bill of rights, which protects all Canadians from hazardous air, water, and soil. I'm not sure why that is. So we are talking about environmental issues. The problem is, we are hesitant to talk about its disproportionality. And yes, we all should be protected as Canadians, but when you don't talk about the fact that certain communities are much more impacted, that's problematic to me. And the most recent bill that I saw was put forward by, I think it was an Albertan woman, MLA, or a politician, that didn't pass. I looked at the bill online. It said nothing about Indigenous communities. One thing to not say anything about Black communities, because the Black communities that are impacted are mostly in Nova Scotia. But we know that Indigenous communities across Canada are dealing with pipelines and other environmental hazards. So for me, an environmental bill of rights that doesn't even make mention of Indigenous communities being most impacted is not an authentic environmental bill of rights to me. I would like to see more discussion on environmental racism. I do know people here in Toronto who are doing that work. And I think people are becoming more familiar with the term just because of, you know, I traveled, I do conferences, I present, I do guest lectures in Ontario and other places, and people are slowly becoming aware of the term and what it means.
Thank you for helping us today.
Thank you very much.
Ingrid Waldron, a professor at Dalhousie University and the author of There's Something in the Water. And that was the Big Story Podcast. For more from us, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. If you like what you hear there, head to your favorite podcast app, I'm mostly thinking Apple, and hit that 5-star button. If you want to talk to us about why you didn't like this particular episode, you can do it at TheBigStoryFPN on Twitter. And of course, you can subscribe for free absolutely anywhere you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.